We're on page 15 of our notes. All right. So we spent last time talking about the difference, the significant disagreement between Paul and Barnabas, which, as I said last week, began as a wisdom issue and degenerated into a passionate issue. And I still think the what I typed for you last time in our notes, that the early church agreed that Paul and Silas were the right choice, and that Barnabas and John Mark were not their choice, right? So they commit Paul and Silas, what does it say? Were committed by the brothers in verse 40 to the grace of the Lord. Now, I don't think that that means that there's an animosity toward John Mark and Barnabas, but there is certainly a recognition that Paul and Silas were correct, that Paul was correct in selecting Silas. So any other thoughts on that? We talked quite a bit about that last week, but you've had time to do some more thinking. Go ahead. Exactly. Correct. Yeah, there's no authorization, which isn't that the issue in Acts 15 about the conference in Jerusalem, is these unauthorized teachers who came down to Antioch, right? And then the church has to, so to speak, spank them at the end of the conference, because you guys didn't have authorization to do this. So in one sense, yes, Barnabas and John Mark, in one sense, yeah, are an unauthorized ministry team. And I think that's a huge thing in our culture. All we need to do, and we have Charles Finney and some others to thank for this back in the 1800s, but God has called me to do this, and it doesn't matter what the church says. Right? That's kind of the American attitude. It's my decision, doesn't matter. Well, actually, it does matter. So the church has the authority, and the church can authorize whom they believe to be, well, as it said there, whom they want to commit to the grace of God, right? Which is a way of saying we're authorizing you. We're recognizing you as the one that God would have for this particular ministry. Now, that's an interesting thought, Mark, that here's Barnabas, who has been sent out and used in different responsibilities, right? From Acts 4, right? For the last 11 chapters, he's been recognized as a trustworthy man, as a man who could be authorized to do different things, and now he's going out unauthorized. You know, that's a big deal. And I'd just be curious if we can have that conversation with him when we see him in heaven. But Barnabas, what's going on here, right? But he, you know, again, the book of Acts tells us that Barnabas, maybe Barnabas is struggling. Isn't he the one who gets swept away by Peter's hypocrisy in Galatians chapter 2? Right? Then maybe he's just struggling spiritually. You know, not everybody is perfect through their entire Christian life. I know that might be a shock for some people, but not everybody is perfect in their walk of faith. And I think maybe what we have here is an example of somebody who starts really well, struggles, and then comes back. You know, because Paul and Peter both, or at least it's Paul, Paul mentions Barnabas positively 5 years later and 10 years later. But right now, he's struggling. So I think that's a very helpful point. I guess my concern is, and I've heard this so many times, is using this paragraph to say, well, you know, now God has two ministry teams. Yes. Right? But it's almost a justification of division. Right? It's like, well, that's okay. It's now we have two. Well, but the church didn't say we have two. The people who were there said we have one. Right? So who are we to come back thousands of years later and say that they were wrong? You know, they said we have one ministry team and it's not Barnabas and John Mark. So, but again, we're Americans and we don't like being under anybody's authority. Right? That's the way we are. And who's going to tell us what to do? Right. So, all right. Anything else on that? If not, let's move ahead now to their itinerary here, verses 41 through, well, at least into chapter early part of chapter 16. They head to Syria and Cilicia, so they're going to head to the north, and then they're going to turn west. This is that area where Paul had ministered roughly 10 years earlier. So maybe, and I said, what did I say? Probably. I think that's safe. Maybe we should say possibly instead of probably, just to be a little more careful. But going back to those churches, the places that he had ministered there, talk to those individuals, maybe stop by and who knows, see his folks, see his relatives, guys he went to school with, whatever, you know what I mean. School reunion, whatever. And then move on to the west, which is what he's going to do. But he heads north and then he heads west into that region of Tarsus. And we notice that it says that he is strengthening the churches. He's not there, again, for sightseeing. He's not there just to, for whatever, but he's there to strengthen churches. That's the significance of this, of these journeys that Paul makes. He ends up making three, I would argue perhaps even four, but he makes at least three travels in which he is establishing and strengthening churches. We need churches. So that's what he does here. That leads us then in chapter 16 and verse 1, that Paul also arrived at Derbe and at Lystra. So he comes here having traveled approximately 150 miles. Now, you can travel roughly 20 miles a day on average for walking. If you're on horseback or you have a mule, you can get closer to 30 miles a day. So that's there's a little more progress there if you can afford the animal, right? I don't know if they had rent a mule type of deals or what, but to travel by walking is one thing. To be able to sit and let the animal do all the walking is a whole other thing, right? So they've traveled, they've made this journey. If it's walking, it's about a week's worth of walking every day. I know sometimes we like to look at our smartphones or our watches and say, ooh, I got in, you know, 600 steps today, and or whatever it is, you know. But there are people who put in, you know, 6 or 7 miles a day, you know. Well, good for them, right? But this, we're talking 20 miles every day. All week, right? And it's not for exercise. This is how they travel, right? To get to where they're going. You and I, 150 miles, but it's past Sioux Falls if we want to go that direction, right? Where else 150 miles would be what, north of the cities a ways, but Rochester is what, 125 miles? So kind of do some thinking that way. But the point is, we can do it easily in an afternoon. They're going to take all week for it. So keep that in mind. And Luke says, behold, a disciple was there. Now again, that concept of behold is obviously he's just drawing attention to this. He says, there was a disciple there. Notice again how Timothy is introduced. He's a disciple, which the Greek word simply means a learner. Okay? Now, it doesn't mean you're a believer. You can be a disciple without being a believer, but you cannot be a believer without being a disciple. So Timothy is identified as a disciple. So he is a disciple. Secondly, we have his name, Timothy, which Timotheos is what it says in Greek, which means to be honored, to honor a god, or to be honored by a god. Now, again, in their culture, it was the husband, it was the father who determined the name of the child. We know Timothy's father is an unbeliever. Okay? So he's not saying, oh, my son, and he's to honor the true God. Right? Timothy is just honoring a God. Okay? That's extremely important to keep in mind. Now, thirdly, he is the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek or a Gentile. So we know 2 Timothy tells us not only his mother's name, but also his grandmother's name. What is it? Is it... it's the chapter 1 and verse 5. Yeah, so his grandmother's name, 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5, being reminded of the unhypocritical faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother, we pronounce it Eunice, and I am convinced that it is in you as well. But she has a name, she has a Greek name, Eunike, which means good victory, is what her name meant, but it's a very Greek name, which tells us that maybe her Jewish influence wasn't quite as strong. She was a Jewess of the diaspora, right? She was still in exile, right? She was not a Palestinian Jew. She was a Jew of the diaspora, of those who had been spread around. Now, she is married to unbelieving Gentile. And on the top of your next page, normally this would have been viewed by the Jews as being a sinful thing. Not always, but normally. And I've given you some references there that you can look up. And we know, for instance, from the book of Ezra, that there was a time when the Jews were commanded to divorce their Gentile spouses, right? To purify there in the book of Ezra. But that was not always the case. But there were times when that took place. Some have argued that Timothy's father, based upon, I think, a misunderstanding of the verb tense here, his father was a Greek. They would say, see, it says was. Well, that's not Luke's point. He's not talking about whether the father's alive or dead. He's just simply saying, mother was Jewish, his father was a Gentile. We've already talked about Lois's influence. When did Lois become a believer? Okay. Don't know. But she and her, now again, grandmother, is that Lois's mom? Or is that the unbelieving Gentile father's mom? doesn't say, right? Could be either one. I'm inclined to think it could be Eunice's mother. However, Luke doesn't give us that distinction. But the point is, Timothy now, as Paul says in 2 Timothy 1, Lois has become a believer. Eunice has become a believer. And now Timothy has become a believer. Now, and we've said this before, and many have said it before me, but God has no grandchildren, right? Just because Lois became a believer doesn't mean that Eunice is guaranteed to be a believer. And just because Lois and Eunice have become believers, there's no guarantee that Timothy would become a believer. Right? Timothy is not a believer because of his mom and his grandma. However, and I've typed in there for you, wives and mothers and grandmothers can have a spiritual influence, and that influence can be either positive or negative. Okay. You need to keep in mind that all women have a tremendous influence upon their family, upon their offspring, and upon their grandchildren. But you need to have a godly influence. You need to have a positive influence. And apparently Timothy was, by the grace of God, privileged to have that. So, that's his family. Notice in verse 2, he is then well spoken of by the brothers who were in Lystra and Iconium. Now, they're roughly a day's travel away from where Timothy is at. But people know him. He has a reputation 20 miles away. Okay, so that's a good thing, right? Now, again, reputations can be good or bad. Right? Timothy has a good reputation. I think that's what Luke is saying here. He is well spoken of by the brothers. The believers in Lystra and Iconium are aware of Timothy. See? So I think that's extremely important as Luke is developing this for us. He is setting the stage for why would Paul want this guy to go along. Okay, he doesn't come into Derby and say, any volunteers? Okay, that's not how it was set up. He comes in and he becomes aware of Timothy and all of these qualifications that Luke has recorded for us. That's all background for why Paul wants Timothy to go along. Who better to go along, right? So verse 3 tells us that Paul wants Timothy to travel. We don't know when exactly Timothy became a believer. Perhaps he was converted during Paul's first visit to this area a few years ago. But it's very likely, and let's look at a couple passages here, and this goes along with the observation earlier about authorization. 1 Timothy chapter 4, we can go back to that. 1 Timothy chapter 4, and let's go to verse 11. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 11. Paul is writing to Timothy. Paul is the representative of Jesus, right? He's the authorized representative of Jesus. So to reject Paul, and this is what we're going to get into in 2 Corinthians, to reject Paul is to reject Christ. Not that Paul is perfect, not that Paul is the personification of Christ, but he is Christ's representative, right? He's the apostle. So to reject the representative is to reject the sender. Now, Paul is getting older, and he's been working with, by the time we get to 1 and 2 Timothy, they've been working together for many years, and Paul has decided that he wants Timothy to be his representative. So the representative of the representative, right? That makes sense? So I don't think Timothy is a pastor. I don't think Paul is a pastor. Timothy is a representative of the apostle who is the representative of Christ. Now, verse 11, command and teach these things. Let no one look down on your youthfulness. Now again, Timothy was in his upper 30s probably by this time frame. What do you 30-year-olds know? You just haven't been around the block enough, right? But show yourself as a model to those who believe in word, conduct, love, faith, and purity. So even though you're young, set the example. Verse 13, until I come, give attention to the public reading of Scripture, to exhortation and teaching. Those seem to be things that should be done within a congregation. Verse 14, do not neglect the gift within you, which was given to you through prophetic utterance with the laying on of hands by the council of elders. When did that happen? I would argue it happens here in Acts 16. When it becomes known that Paul wants to take Timothy along, Paul still is in the business of establishing churches, and part of establishing churches is making sure things are done rightly. And that Timothy is recognized by that body of elders, and apparently some spiritual gift was given to him to enable him to do the job of being Paul's representative. I'm not going to take the time, but you can see the other one in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 6. My point is this. Paul wants official authorization of Timothy. Paul cannot authorize Timothy. The church needs to authorize Timothy. Just like was highlighted earlier, the church in Antioch authorizes Paul and Silas, right? So I think we have that continuity and that consistency taking place. Now, verse 3, back in Acts 16 and verse 3, this is why it takes us so long to get through this, but Paul wanted this man to go with him. And if we would just stop there, we would all say, that's really nice. And then we read on. And so he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews of those parts. Now, it's one thing to circumcise an 8-day-old baby. It's a whole other thing to circumcise an adult male, right? It's two totally different things. But Timothy, depending on, what I've been reading related to this cultural issue here, Timothy is viewed by the Jews as a Jew because of his mother. So there's two different perspectives within Judaism. Some look at the offspring, who is Jewish based upon the mother. Some look upon the offspring as being Jewish based upon the father. Okay. So we can't go back and say all Jews always believed. There's two different strains, if you will, of thinking. But he is viewed as a non-conforming hybrid Jew. Why? Because he's not circumcised. Okay, which would be unthinkable, right, to the average Jewish individual. So he may be Jewish, but he is certainly not fully Jewish, right, is the idea. That's why he is going to be circumcised. The Gentiles will look at Timothy as being a Jew because he would be brought up according to his mother's religion. Okay? Moms have an influence. Now, if his father, this Gentile father, had taken Timothy over to the temple of, you'd have to look it up, and what what did they all worship in Derby, but let's just say the worship of the emperor, or the worship of Aphrodite, or the worship of Cybele, or whomever it is, sometimes the fathers cared enough about their kids and pushed them into a specific religion. Otherwise, it was just left to the moms. Okay. Well, we know Eunice and Lois had become believers at some point, and apparently had enough influence by the Spirit of God to share the gospel with Timothy, and Timothy became a believer. Now, we know Timothy is circumcised here because he's regarded as a Jew. Titus, and I've given you the notes there, Titus, who is a Gentile, is not required to be circumcised, and for which Titus is very grateful, right? But why Titus and not Timothy? Paul's being inconsistent. No, actually, he's being very consistent. Because Timothy was regarded as a Jew. And if he's regarded as a Jew, when he goes to the bathhouse or when he goes over to the river and takes a bath, people are going to know if he's circumcised or not. Nobody cares about Titus being circumcised. He doesn't need to be because he's a Gentile. So it's not Paul being inconsistent, it's actually Paul being consistent. So, verse 4. Now, while they were passing through the cities, they were delivering the decrees, plural, which had been decided upon by the apostles and the elders who were in Jerusalem for them to keep. We mentioned this earlier. Acts 15, the statement in Acts 15 gets passed on to all the churches, right? So Paul is still fulfilling, and Silas is still fulfilling his responsibility. Remember, he was chosen to take the decree down to Antioch. And now he's taken, because he's still the authorized representative from the conference in Jerusalem. He's fulfilling his duty. So Paul and Silas are doing what was expected of them. They're submitting to the authorities over them. They are following the principles that have been laid out for them. The word decrees there, we get our English word, you can see there, we get our English word dogma from, right? Sometimes we use that word, maybe not as much as years ago, but we sometimes say to people, quit being so dogmatic, right? You're only thinking of it just from this one, and that's related to this word, okay? However, dogma is still a positive thing. Everybody has dogma. Everybody has a set of beliefs. Everybody has theology, and that is what is referred to here. Now, real quickly, verse 5. Luke gives to us his third progress report in this section, and he tells us two things were happening at this time. So the churches were being strengthened in the faith. So that's an internal, doctrinal issue. The faith, not always, but we'll do this real quick, I think. So there's a difference between faith and the faith. Okay? Not always, but normally when Paul uses the definite article the faith, what he's referencing is this body of doctrine that all the churches hold to. It's the faith. When he doesn't use the definite article, which is normal, it can sometimes be the faith. We can understand it to be the faith, but oftentimes it's a reference to faith of the individual in Christ, the faith of the individual in God the Father. Do you have the faith? Do you have faith? Do you believe the faith? Okay? That's a different thing, right? So you can, in the New Testament Greek, and again, I don't have the exact verb forms here, so just bear with me. I'll just transliterate it, though. But you could say, so this first one is the verb, and this is the noun. So do you believe the faith? Okay? That makes sense? So pistuo pistis. Do you believe the, are you believing the faith? Or I am believing the faith. Okay? Now I could simply say, I am believing. Right? And you assume, what is it you're believing? Okay, you assume, well, you're believing God, you're believing the gospel, you're believing Christ, right? But to say, I am believing the faith, there's a standard that I must hold to. There's a standard of doctrine, okay? It's the faith. And we see that expression in the New Testament. Don't ask me how many times right now, but it is found commonly in the New Testament. There is a standard, right? We are not simply left as individuals to make up our own doctrinal statement. Okay, there is, we use the word, we use the word orthodoxy or orthodox, right? You conform to a standard, right? In fact, this, the letter R here, and I've been asked this several times, what do we mean with the, why did the Association of Churches, it's the Minnesota Association of Regular Baptist Churches. What does the word regular mean? It was used as a synonym for Orthodox. They didn't want to say Orthodox Baptist Churches. So the early leaders in the association back in the 30s, it's been almost 100 years ago, wow, opted for regular instead of orthodox, because that would have been really confusing in certain areas, right? Oh, you're an Orthodox Baptist church, as opposed to a Russian Orthodox or a Greek Orthodox, right? So, but that's what the term means. But the point is, there's a standard of doctrine. Right? There's a doctrinal statement, and you're expected to believe that. You're expected to follow that. So when you unite with a local church, you, one of the things you do is you say, I am in general agreement with the doctrinal statement. And if I disagree, I disagree in these areas. Now, a new believer doesn't have all that doctrine figured out in their heads, right? So they are taking, by faith, the statement of faith, right? But we're saying this is what we as a congregation have agreed to, and those of you who have been around long enough remember how we sat down and tweaked our statement of faith and brought it clarified and standardized a few things, and we looked at other doctrinal statements to help compile and to clarify ours. So there's the faith that needs to be embraced by those who have faith. Right? That makes sense? So Paul says, real quickly, they are being strengthened in the faith, and secondly, there's a numeric or external increase. And were abounding in number daily. The churches were growing numerically. Now, in order for that to happen, then there needs to be evangelism that is taking place, right? But his emphasis here is not so much on the sharing of the gospel. He's telling us the results of the sharing of the gospel. Okay? All right. I'm going to stop